hello, everyone, and welcome to the End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Andrea Pettiberi.
And Andrea, it is such a pleasure to have you here, because if there was a joy to this week's movie selection, it was that you made it and not me. So...
Yes. Thank you for letting me choose. I'm sure you regret it now.
We'll see. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans, and we are here every Thursday at 10 a.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the, whatever this is, but there's been three of them, 50 Shades Freed. That's in the back half of the show. For the first half, we'll talk about some recent news items from the week, including the year 1999. You wouldn't think that'd be news, but it's now fondly remembered in one Globe and Mail article as one of the last great years for movies before franchise fever hit Hollywood, and that's according to that author, and we'll talk about that and maybe why that may or not be true. And then, do you still buy physical DVDs and Blu-rays? Is buying the physical disc the last refuge of the collector? Are we all just streamers now? Should we be? We'll talk about the game change. But first, speaking of games, last week was the big game, as it were, the Super Bowl. And I don't know, are you a football fan, Andrea?
I'm not. I do enjoy the Super Bowl, though, because my parents have these friends who throw a huge Super Bowl party with great food, which is what I'm all about. And I usually go with them. But this year was kind of heartbreaking because my parents didn't even invite me. So I missed out this year.
Snub. The mom and dad snub.
Yeah.
It was a pretty big week for movie trailers. And we'll run down a few of them. But I think the biggest one was probably, I don't know how many, I sent you like a laundry list of trailers to watch. I apologize for that.
That's okay.
This isn't a homework intensive show, but.
They're like 2 minutes long. I can handle it.
Oh, good. You're a game day player, to further our sports metaphor. But I think the biggest one was Solo, Star Wars Story, which is the next Star Wars movie. And I don't know if you are aware of the behind-the-scenes drama on that, but I think this was a pretty big... You're shaking your head no.
No.
But, I mean, it's a pretty big deal because of that behind-the-scenes drama, and everyone's been like, where's the trailer? Where's the trailer? And I guess the feeling is that things behind the scenes have been so bad that they haven't wanted to put out a trailer yet, but it turns out they were just waiting for the Super Bowl. Are you a Star Wars fan?
I feel like I could be. I just, so, yeah, I told Adam this earlier, but I'm actually really bad. I hardly ever watch movies. I've always wanted to watch the entire Star Wars series. Last year, I was dating somebody who made me watch the trilogy, the original trilogy, which I very much enjoyed, but just never got around to watching the rest. So, yeah, I enjoyed it, and I'm sure I will enjoy the other ones, but...
But what did you think? Just seeing wanted to get like the origin of Han Solo.
Yeah.
Are you excited about?
Actually, I am. He was my favorite character. Yeah. So yeah.
Yeah, and it's. I mean, I was kind of dubious about this too because of Star Wars and prequels. And, but yeah, and then there was all the behind the scenes stuff. And to recap for you and presumably others who don't listen, there were two directors on this: the guys behind the Lego Movie and 21 Jump Street, Phil Lord and Chris Miller. They were fired. Literally with a few weeks left before shooting was to be ended, and they were replaced with Ron Howard, who then went and did like 3 months of reshoots. So not the best foot that you want to step off on. But I like Alden Ehrenreich as Han Solo. There's that scene at the end where he's like, it'll be fine, we're fine. And that was such a Han Solo moment. And everyone's like been really excited about Donald Glover as Lando.
I love Donald Glover, so I was excited when I saw him in the trailer.
The facial hair is like out of control. It's like straight out of like Superfly. It's amazing, and he's. I don't think it was in the main trailer, but in the Super Bowl clip, he was like wearing this like bearskin like fur coat, and everyone was like, "That coat!" It was crazy. Another big one we got was Mission Impossible. The next Mission Impossible. Have you seen any of the...
I have not.
No.
I wasn't kidding.
I thought it looked great. But, Tom Cruise, more Tom Cruise stunt insanity, this time hanging from a helicopter.
Yeah.
So, good for him. Was there one that jumped out at you? Like, I have to see that one?
Yeah, A Quiet Place.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I mean, most of them were all, like, action-packed movies, which I'm not really about, but I love horror films. Those are, like, the only movies that, like, when there's a new horror movie that comes out, I have to go see that. And that looked like it is probably a horror movie.
Yeah. So. No, it's strange that it kind of gave us more detail about what is going on in that world. Because the other one... There's a trailer that came out for it before that is kind of just strictly about how this family lives in quiet. But why do they have to be quiet? Why are they talking in sign language and walking around barefoot? And it's not revealed why they live in the quiet place. But this trailer lent us some insight.
Yeah, it looks very intriguing.
Yeah. So I take it you're also not a Deadpool fan.
No, I actually, that trailer confused me. I didn't really know what was happening.
Deadpool. Yeah, he breaks the fourth wall.
Yeah, that's, yeah. There's a lot of that going on.
Yeah, there's a lot of inside jokes about Justice League. The inside joke, because you saw the Mission Impossible one with Henry Cavill, who has a mustache. He had to go do reshoots for Justice League, where he plays Superman, who does not have a mustache, and he was barred from shaving the mustache.
Oh, okay.
So that was the inside joke. But, I thought it was funny, and I think for people who like the first Deadpool and the marketing they're in, where it's kind of all jokey and self-referential, I think this shows that the Deadpool 2 will keep up that that spirit, and even though it's like James Brolin as a very serious character named Cable, who is part cyborg. This is where reading the comic books for years comes handy. are you a Dwayne Johnson fan? You said you don't like action, but you like The Rock.
I watched wrestling growing up, so.
Really?
I grew up with boys, and they were all very into wrestling, so I...
And you had one TV where you had to get up and change the channel?
Yeah.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, so I've got a soft spot for him, because I grew up watching him.
Yeah, he's in a new one called Skyscraper, which is like Die Hard meets The Towering Inferno meets The Rock. So it's interesting in that one. It makes a very big deal of him being an amputee. Not that Dwayne Johnson is an amputee, but he's playing an amputee. So he's not only got to save his family and save this building that is like terrorized or something. That's not exactly clear in the trailer, but that he's going to do it all with one leg. Although he's still like running across scaffolding and leaping and
yeah.
But he's a solid actor in these things, so I might check that out. I was a bit dubious by the description, but speaking of dubious, did you watch the one for Venom?
I did.
Where it looks like generic Tom Hardy movie.
Yeah.
Do you understand that it's about a Spider-Man villain called Venom?
Yeah, I was a Spider-Man fan growing okay. up. So it actually took me a minute, and then I remember that I had a Venom action figure. I was like, oh, it's a Spider-Man thing.
Because not only do you never see him as like Venom, not even like a quick tease or something. The trailer ends with like the little Venom face, but unless you know it's Venom, there's nothing to say. It's a Venom movie, and there's the Marvel logo at the beginning, but
it's pretty subtle.
It's pretty subtle. Yes, it's pretty subtle. Like I said, it looks like generic Tom Hardy action movie, and I'm sure he'll be great. He's usually great, but he's riding a motorcycle and he's walking around and he's all angry. But there's nothing to say like, "Hey, it's Venom, Venom," and that's kind of a, or to say that it's like R-rated because it's going to be like an R-rated kind of hard R movie, and like I guess kind of in the Deadpool Logan mold. There's nothing really to say that this is going to be that kind of movie that's going to stand apart and try and be something else, or that it's really like a superhero movie or anything. I mean, it was just kind of blah, so I can understand why people were disappointed with that. I guess we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about the surprise The Netflix dropped Cloverfield, the next Cloverfield movie, Cloverfield mm-hmm. Paradox, which I haven't, admittedly did not get a chance to watch yet, but I think that surprise sort of came and went. You like scary movies, but it's...
Yeah, I actually didn't end up seeing the... Is this the third Cloverfield?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I haven't seen the other ones, actually.
I'm not sure it's the story is that complex. It's not like 50 Shades of Grey, Gerald, where it's so many complex storylines. But I haven't got a chance to watch it either. But from all appearances, it seems to have been like kind of dumped on Netflix, and they kind of like maximized their spoils by like just kind of like, surprise, it's a Cloverfield movie on Netflix tonight after the big game. And I haven't really heard anybody talk about it since. So anyway. There is another Cloverfield movie in the can, so.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It takes place during World War II.
Oh, wow.
So now you know.
Yeah.
It'll be the Cloverfield War or something. I don't know. Anyway, that brings us to 1999, oddly enough. Mm-hmm. Almost 20 years ago.
Yeah.
I feel old. So in the Globe and Mail, there was this article about how... It's kind of like one of these articles that come up every now and then. Like, when was the last time there was a really great period of film? And this person supposes it was 1999, so that was the year we got The Matrix, Office Space, Iron Giant, Sixth Sense, Blair Witch, Fight Club, American Beauty, Magnolia, Election. And, you know, I was thinking about this morning, and, you know, all like a lot of those directors, like the Wachowskis who did The Matrix, they did The Matrix sequels, which were not well thought of in the end. You had Office Space, which was directed by Mike Judge, which a lot of people like Idiocracy, but that's a cult movie. It's not really, and given that we now kind of live in the Idiocracy timeline, people aren't really enjoying it as satire anymore. And then we have Sixth Sense, where M. Night Shyamalan was in the wilderness for years until he made Split. So, that promise kind of fizzled out. And Blair Witch, I actually interviewed one of the directors of the Blair Witch.
Oh, cool.
A couple of years ago when they released the remake. And there are two other people who were had this promising career that didn't come to much. And I'm like, was 1999 that great? Anyway, you said you had only seen a couple of these because you're not a...
Yeah. Yeah, which were the ones that I'd seen? can I see your list?
You can see the list, sure. I'm sharing my notes, which is weird for me. But
which were the ones?
Can you read my writing?
No, I'm going to just pull up the article.
But
you might have to cut this out.
No, we'll leave it in. But he makes a particular emphasis to talk about like franchises too, and I looked at the list, and there are like four of the top 10 that year were sequels or remakes. Two of the other top 10s launched franchises themselves. So it's, you know, when you kind of look at the fine print on these things, it's never really kind of one thing. And I think, again, these are articles that come out every now and then,
mm-hmm.
and what he's kind of supposing is just sort of like what the nature of the business is, which is there are good years for movies and there are not so good years for movies, although sometimes you have to dig to find the gold, and that's life.
Yeah.
Anyway, you pulled up the article, so I played for time there.
Yes, I saw Galaxy Quest.
Yes.
I love that one.
I like Galaxy Quest too. It's a shame that it or maybe it's not a shame that it, given sometimes sequels aren't as good as the original. Sometimes alchemy happens and you get a really good movie. But, that's kind of, I think, the point of this, too, is, sometimes the elements just kind of come together to produce something really great, and sometimes it goes, like, back to back to back like this. And,
The thing is, though, that, I don't know, I was thinking about this and, like, it's true, like, for a lot of the blockbusters, the things that are coming out that are, like, highly advertised, I don't really have much interest in, and a lot of them are sequels or remakes, but my best friend, she studied film, and so she's always making me watch, like, indie movies and stuff, and I feel like there are tons of great independent movies that are coming out, so, I don't think that, like, that film has necessarily gone downhill since 1999. You just kind of have to dig for the gold.
out. Yeah, that's, I mean, that's, I mean, we've come off a streak the last several weeks where we've talked about Call Me By Your Name and Shape of Water and The Post, yeah, and, you know, all these movies that, you know, are not, you know, opening up with like $100 million, $150 million and are, you know, maybe slow to come out. Shape of Water was released in limited release like back in December, and then it finally, you know, arrives here at the end of January.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's, I guess when you just kind of look at the surface, because I also looked at what else came out in 1999 that maybe weren't hits. So we have My Favorite Martian, which both of us are too young to remember when it aired on TV.
I think I remember that movie, though.
I think it had Christopher Lloyd, yeah, as the Martian. And then one of my personal favorites, The Rage, Carrie 2.
I didn't even know about that.
You didn't know they made a sequel to Carrie? No. 25 years after,
oh, wow,
the fact?
Yeah. Was it written by Stephen King?
No. I think it was an instance of them having like a Carrie-like screenplay and then adding Carrie 2 to the
That's
title.
That's great.
But there was also, the Mod Squad movie, The Wild Wild West, Inspector Gadget, the live-action Inspector Gadget starring Matthew Broderick as Inspector Gadget, Dudley Do Right, which was also live-action starring, I think it was Brendan Fraser, Universal Soldier, The Return, and another personal favorite of mine, Pokemon, the first movie. So confident they were that they put the first movie in the title.
I think that was the first movie that ever made me cry.
Really?
Yeah.
We should dedicate an episode to dissecting that. But you know, I think there's a point here that, you know, that there's also maybe a critical mass, because 1999 was also a year after 98, which was like a year with like a lot of different bombs. And I looked up some of the movies from 1998 that were like quote-unquote franchise movies. So you had like Blues Brothers 2000, U.S. Marshals, Lost in Space, speaking of flashbacks, Odd Couple 2, Species 2, Three Ninjas 3, two threes, High Noon at Mega Mountain, Godzilla, Lethal Weapon 4, and of course now they're talking about Lethal Weapon 5, Halloween H2O, The Avengers, not the Marvel one, like the remake of the 60s British one with Sean Connery and his weather control device, and then I Still Know What You Did Last Summer.
Oh.
So, that was 98.
Yeah.
Going back to 1997. But it's, you know, I think Hollywood comes in these waves where they get sequel happy and IP happy. And I think the difference now is, and this is like the one good point that was made in the Globe, not an original point, but that, you know, a lot of the people who would go on and make like the quote unquote adult movies for, you know, a reasonable budget, not like the $200 or $100 million budgets. But, you know, those people have now gone to TV.
Yeah.
Which is now, if you want to like engaging adult drama,
mm-hmm,
there's about 600 different choices there. And not an original point, but, you know, which is also explains why the markets may be split now between the big blockbusters and the smaller indies.
Yeah, but that makes sense. Yeah, I feel like we're really in like a golden age of TV right now. So it's probably detracting from the movies.
You watch a lot of TV?
I do. Netflix, yes.
See, so you're part of the problem. But yeah, I mean, that's where kind of all that effort is going, because if you can tell a story, I guess people are more willing to watch like 8 or 9 episodes of a more like adult centric story. Something,
yeah,
like, I don't know, I'm watching Counterpart on Crave TV, which is about like alternate universes and has J.K. Simmons, who's an Oscar winner, but he's playing himself from our world and himself from, not J.K. Simmons, but he's playing his character from our world and his character from an alternative universe. So, I mean, there's obviously more of an appeal there if you're looking for acting challenge. Meryl Streep, who's going to be on the next season of Pretty Little Liars, which, not Pretty Little Liars, I always get them confused, Big Little Lies. Pretty Little Liars is something else entirely. But yeah, with Nicole Kidman and Reese Witherspoon are, you know, other Oscar-winning actresses.
Yeah.
So, I think that's where the juice is going, shall we say.
Yeah, definitely.
I feel like I'm not letting you talk enough.
Oh, that's okay. You have more to say than I do.
How about you said you're a big Netflix fan.
Yeah.
Do you still buy the physical media?
I actually recently started getting into purchasing DVDs. And
you
Blu-ray
just started again. Getting into DVDs? Yeah,
like within the past year.
Interesting.
Because I had always, it's like my first time living on my own before I had roommates, so we would all purchase unlimited internet together, like we'd all pay for it. I don't have that anymore, so I have limited bandwidth. So I'm always exceeding my bandwidth and then paying crazy amounts for the internet. Mm-hmm. So I've decided I'm just going to start purchasing DVDs. That's cheaper, and then I can watch and not worry about ruining my internet.
That's interesting, because I feel like that's one of that was something I didn't think of, because I do have unlimited internet at home. But That is a good point, that in all this streamingness, because we're talking about, it was an article posted on Collider by one of their movie writers, Matt Goldberg, and he's like, basically, I guess he was letting off some steam about not being able to watch Air Force One on July 4th like he usually does, and how he couldn't find it on any of the streaming channels, but how he had it on Blu-ray, but it was in storage because he was moving, and this is something I'm kind of fascinated by, because I still buy and collect the physical discs. Even though I moved off that with like music, I don't buy the physical CDs anymore. I buy on iTunes or wherever, on SoundCloud or wherever there is music. And and this was about 10 years ago, I finally made that full transition. And I wondered how long it would take to go that way with movies. And it's never taken with me. I
have a theory.
Oh, go ahead.
About
yes.
That actually.
Please.
So I, like, my favorite media is literature. Like, I'm a crazy reader, and like so many of my friends and like my mom, I'll buy like ebooks. But for me, I love literature so much that I have to have the physical copy, and I love having like my apartment full of these things that I love. And I feel like people, the media that they gravitate towards, they'll probably be more likely to want to own the physical copy because to them it's something they're very passionate about, and like MP3 or an MP4, they're so intangible, and I don't know, I just think it has to do with what you love and you want to have it around.
You could be right, but I mean, I also tend to see more older people with like Kindles and things. Like if I see a young person reading, chances are they have the physical book. People I see tend to have Kindles, which is weird. You would think it'd be the reverse, but
yeah.
It seems to be like a generational quirk.
That's interesting.
Yeah. But in terms of availability, too, one of the things I notice about Netflix is that, and I think a lot of us know, things come and go. Mm-hmm. And I do wonder if people sort of have an appreciation for that, you know, today I can go and watch Cloverfield on Netflix, but you know, starting next month it might not be there anymore. And if I really want to watch Cloverfield, what do I do? Mm-hmm. I guess I could go to iTunes or Google Play or someplace like that. But you know, what happens if it's like something older, something that's not as widely available? You know, you're kind of stuck. I wonder if there's maybe a backlog coming. You know, I used to work at Thomas Video before it closed, and you know, people, if they couldn't find it on iTunes or they couldn't find it on the library or at Netflix or whatever, there was the option of the video store, and that option isn't there, at least not in Guelph. And in very few places, the option is there, where you can go into these cavernous places. And also there's that sense of discovery, too. It's a bit easier to discover things when you're walking amongst the shelves, rather than, you know, on Netflix, and it's, you know, scrolling through that. And I used to think I was the only one who would sit there like with Netflix open, going, "Oh, what do I want to watch? Scroll, scroll, scroll."
Yeah.
And no, this is apparently a thing a lot of people do. So I think when you go out somewhere and you grab a disc, there's something very decisive about that is lost in the Netflix.
And also, I find that Netflix and those streaming services are terrible for when it comes to like foreign films.
Yeah.
I love like French. I'm from Quebec, so I love like watching French movies, and like I have never come across any really on Netflix. Whereas I love going to Thomas Video and like, you guys had a huge section there that I would look through. And then also, I'm a big fan of like BBC shows. And so I loved when you were able to like trick Netflix into thinking that you were in Europe. And then when they stopped doing that, I was like, oh, there's like so much less that I want to watch now. So
they outsmarted us. But I mean, that's the availability thing, I think, is so key because I love taking shots at Bell Media, and I will again. But the president of Bell was talking about people who pirate Game of Thrones. And like, well, if you don't, if you keep pirating Game of Thrones, no one's going to make a Game of Thrones. And it's like, well, you know what? Who controls the Canadian distribution rights of Game of Thrones? You do. And you know, what Bell Media forces you to do if you want to watch the new season of Game of Thrones and you want to do it right, you have to get a cable package. And you have to subscribe to not just the cable, but to the movie network and HBO and all these specialty channels, which cost you more money. And in what HBO does in the United States is offer a streaming-only service where you can pay, I think it's $15.99, but then you get access to what's on HBO right this minute, as well as everything HBO has ever done. Meanwhile, you know, Bell is, you know, kind of hoarding a lot of TVs for as you know, I guess, bait for you to come and buy their cable subscription. Which, you know, should tell you everything about, you know, why people are pirating Game of Thrones like they are. You know, they don't want to buy your box and your packages. And instead of just offering people what they want. So, I mean, there's still, in so much as there's a paradigm shift, like, happening in the U.S., there's also a shift happening that needs to happen up here, too, with, you know, there's stuff that, you know, is just so hard to find. Like Mr. Robot. I've wanted to get into Mr. Robot, but there's no streaming service that has Mr. Robot, which is, you know, stinks because, you know, I'm not going to run out and buy Mr. Robot DVDs in the off chance I like the show. You know, you want to take it for a test taste, as it were.
Yeah, but definitely.
I feel like this has gone all over the place, and I think we're just trying to stall for time, but we got to talk about 50 Shades Freed.
We got to do it.
So to warm us up, because I think we're going to throw some shade, we will play The Shade, which is a little Matrix, a little Metric ditty. I'm flashing back to 1999. But here's here's Metric with The Shade. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio.
It is Gia, right? I'm sure you're very good at what you do. Otherwise, Christian wouldn't have asked for your input. But please stop speaking to my husband as if I weren't here.
Anna. I have designed many prestige projects.
You may call me Mrs. Gray. And this is not a prestige project. This is gonna be our home. So, if you want this job, I suggest you stop making eyes at my husband and keep your hands to yourself.
Look, I'm sorry, Mrs. Gray, but I would never. It won't happen again.
That was Boss. I did enjoy that clip, by the way. So that was a clip from 50 Shades Freed, which is the new film from James Foley, starring Dakota Johnson, Jamie Dornan, Eric Johnson, Louise Mumford, Luke Grimes, and Marcia Gay Harden. Marcia Gay Harden, what are you doing here? You won an Oscar! Anyway.
Which one was she?
She's Christian Grey's mom.
Oh, okay.
She's literally in this for 2.5 seconds.
Yeah.
but she got a credit. She, poor Marcia Gay Harden. She's worked so hard. So we're giggling. I want to take this seriously.
All right.
Maybe not that serious. But, you know, we had a list of two or three potentials mm-hmm. for the week. And as we said at the beginning, this was your selection. What about 50 Shades Freed? Jumped out to you, Andrea.
Well, my other options were more action-y movies, which, as I mentioned, not
your bag.
About.
Yeah.
But then also the 50 Shades series has... I haven't read any of the books or seen any of the movies before, but just the phenomenon of it really interests me, the way people like latched onto it and it became so popular. And all the criticism that I've heard about it, it all just interested me. And so I wanted to experience it for the first time. And so I did.
So how was it?
I feel like all of the criticism I heard was very fair.
Great, episode over. It's funny, I walked into the Saturday afternoon screening, and I was me by myself. Everybody in there was like there as a group, like ladies there as a group for I guess girls afternoon out or something, or couples. And as I walk in, and I'm walking up the stairs to like take a seat, and there's like this one older couple there, and the gentleman, it's like he makes eye contact with me for like a second. He's like, "You're here by yourself. What is wrong with you?"
Yeah,
like, we're all hostages here. Everyone with a Y chromosome is a hostage here. But I'm with you. I did check out 50 Shades Darker, which is the predecessor to this one, mm-hmm. when it was on the Movie Network. I was looking for something in the background as I was working and on my computer just to have something on that was just to fill the noise. And I chose this and was very unimpressed. And so I went into this one with very low expectations. It's a very problematic movie.
Oh, yeah.
But I think this is better than 50 Shades Darker.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. I'm saying a lot.
Because, okay, plot synopsis for 50 Shades Darker starting now. Basically, these two meet in the first movie, and he wants her to be this contract with his submissive, and he wants her to sign a contract. She's like, "No, that's nuts," understandably so. But they get back together in part two, but now they're being stalked by one of his old submissives. And meanwhile, she's working at this publishing company, and the boss turns out to be psycho, and stuff happens, and Christian gets lost in the woods for what feels like an hour, but then they get married at the end, and it just there's like it feels like very Lifetime movie, very like Woman in Peril kind of movie of the week kind of, and there was less of that in this one,
okay,
which I appreciated, even though when it did go into movie of the week territory with the psycho boss returning, and by the way, Eric, first of all. The old boss, his name is Hyde, which is like little on the nose, 50 Shades. But he's played by Eric Johnson, who is Canada's Paul Walker. He's like very bland, very he should be like doing like the good guy roles, like he's a cop who's conflicted because he identifies with the main gang leader, but he's too good to go to the dark side. But instead he goes full on dark side. So Eric Johnson. Eric Johnson should stick with being Canada's Paul Walker. It's what he was built for. But in this movie, it's like he's like Tom Cruise in Mission Impossible because he's like hacking stuff and he's like setting up explosives and it's crazy that this guy is like in the book business or like fired from the book business and he's not like doing counter espionage and so that was kind of problematic to me. just that this guy, like, I guess, you know, even if they threw in a line like, I Googled how to make explosives.
Yeah, I had brought my friend with me. Actually, I didn't want to go alone, but I didn't want to subject any of my friends to it. But then I remembered one of my friends is a sex therapist, so I brought her with me. And yeah, just throughout the movie, whenever it was just like romance, and then all of a sudden action would kick in, and she would lean over and whisper in my ear, "It's a spy movie now." And then later on, it's now a thriller.
Yeah. It's what was her reaction to the sex? Because I think this is like, it's supposed to be like risque, and it's like the most boring sex in the world. Like, there's stuff on Reddit that's riskier than this. It's not impressed.
I think both her and I felt the same way about it. I don't know. I guess it's just, this is like the first time that pseudo S&M has sort of attained some level of popularity, and so people who haven't really been exposed to that sort of like risque side of sex are like really excited by it.
I mean, the message of the movie is like, this is a great outlet if you're like messed up in your personal life, which is, I don't think the message that you want to send, that people who enjoy kinky sex are messed up.
Yeah, I mean, it just seemed the whole time like he would take her into the red room when she had upset him. Yeah. And that's like, no, healthy couples do not resolve their problems in that way. That's not how it works.
This is so, first of all, this guy is wood. That wasn't a double entendre. he's completely wooden. There is like no charisma here at all.
Oh no.
Second of all, he like flips out when things don't go his way.
Yeah.
And it's like, how do you become a billionaire if you like just like freak out and fall apart when the plan comes apart?
Absolutely.
Because it's just so bizarre. And then the third part of it is like just the possessiveness of this. And I think I like the Dakota Johnson character, Anna, because she's got gumption. She's a little tenacious. She like kind of knows the score. But this guy, there's a scene where they're like honeymooning, I guess in Italy or somewhere in the Mediterranean, but it's a topless beach, and she's like, "I'm going to go topless too." And he's like, "No, you don't."
Yeah.
And she's like, I think her line is like, literally, it's like a Boobarama here. So first of all, she's absolutely correct. Second of all, his counter argument is like, you can get some on the cover of some sleazy tabloid. And I'm like, first of all, going back to point one, who cares what you're doing? Seriously.
Yeah.
Like, really? Like, paparazzi are following this guy around? Like, how many like random billionaires just have paparazzi following them around? It's nobody's following you. You just don't want.
Yeah.
You just want to be so controlling of your wife's sexuality. It's quite bizarre.
Yeah, I feel like I didn't like Anna's character though. She seemed very Mary Sue to me. Like I just so she did, like in that clip you played at the beginning, very assertive, and then at other points, like that topless scene, she would assert herself. But then the like crap she put up with from him, and like, yeah, married to a petulant child. I feel like a real assertive person would not put up with the crap he put her through. So I was just like, what is her character? Like, what's her deal? I can't figure her out.
Yeah, I mean, that is tricky. There are times like in that clip where she's like, she clearly knows what she's doing. And then when stalker guy comes, you know, crawling out of the woodwork, she immediately falls into this weepiness, and you know, the first thing is, of course, grabbing a gun and doing exactly what he wants, and it's so bipolar, I guess is the way to describe that. It's like there's no kind of overarching like development for her character. Although having said that, she is overdeveloped as compared to Christian Grey.
Yeah.
Just,
I can't, like, I don't know what she sees in him.
It's never really explained what he does. Like, he's professionally rich, and he's always going, like, I'm going to New York tomorrow. Okay, how about why?
Yeah. But he, like, works he's one of her bosses, right?
Yeah, so, I think he owns the publishing company.
Okay. So she's always joking about books.
Apparently. she's always joking about my boss's boss's boss.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, real slave driver. But yeah, it's that's another, speaking of Mary Sue-ness, everything works out.
Yeah.
Everything is like, it just comes together so well. Like she's like the new fiction editor. I can't believe I paid this much attention of her publishing company. And her boss comes in at one point. It's like, you were right about that new author. We're selling hundreds of thousands of copies. First of all, this publisher is called Seattle Independent Press. Independent Press isn't selling hundreds and thousands of copies of nothing. But just like, this is her first major book. And he's like, it's not only a home run. You've won us the World Series. And every kind of conflict or argument, it's like resolved with like, let's go to like someplace really rich and awesome, mm-hmm. or sex, mm-hmm. and it's and then it all comes, everybody who is bad goes to jail or dies, everyone who is good gets to go on with their life and just have this like awesome kick-ass life like from Paris to Aspen. And
yeah, I mean, it just came across to me as like clearly just being these fantasies that this woman had. E.L. James is a woman.
Yes.
That she had, and she just needed some sort of flimsy plot to like string them all together and showcase them. And so, yeah, she had some conflict, but I mean, I don't know. It didn't. Yeah, I was not into it.
Yeah, it's. It's so weird, and it's so weird that so much effort went into something this kind of crappy.
Yeah.
Because it's gorgeous, the shots and the cinematography is like really well done, and mm-hmm. and when they set its things to music and it's the way it's edited, these are like a series of like 6 or 8 really great music videos.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's a lot of effort for not a lot of. There.
Yeah.
Because, let me say this about the story. I think there's something compelling here. And I don't just mean like the BDSM or the sexist stuff, but, the idea of how do you, manage like that kind of relationship? How do you manage, having a partner who is, let's be honest, not all there, mm-hmm. Who is the petulant child. How do you, create identity for yourself when you're young and, newly married? There's a thing where she's like, do I want to take his last name? Like, keep my married or my maiden name as like a professional? And that seems to get resolved fairly quickly because he's like, no, you take my name. Mm-hmm. And she's like, okay, whatever. And, there are interesting gender dynamics that could be explored that I feel like this story surfs on, but never wants to indulge in because it's better to go to, Aspen and hike and awesome mountain air.
Yeah, I mean, definitely I feel like there was potential for that sort of discourse, but I feel like in the ways that it was, that any of them were resolved, it was always in, like, the patriarchal way. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's definitely a lot of misogyny in this film.
And that's what's interesting, considering it was the source material comes from a woman.
Yeah.
That kind of comes through. Even though at the, I mean, there's something so, excuse me, disingenuous about the end. And yeah, let's spoil it. I mean, she finds out she's pregnant at one point. And then she does have the great line when he's like freaking out about it. And she's like, look, like sometimes a consequence of sex is getting pregnant, and we've had a lot of sex. it was just straight up, which I appreciated. But, she has this kind of like feminist moment when he kind of goes out and drinks and hangs out with an old girlfriend.
Yeah.
Where she's like, you know what? It's like, I will do this without you if I have to, but I would like to do this with you. Like, we're partners and we're married and all that. And there's kind of no suit. He kind of like goes off and like in a huff again, and then she gets kidnapped. But you know, but then immediately after that, he's cool with it. It's all good, and then there's an actual post credit sequence where it shows them like with the kid who's I guess like one or two at that point, but you know, and they're all happy, like one big happy family. And Christian's a great dad. And did the audience react when they showed the kid?
There were only like five other people in the
audience. Okay, because when the scene came up and Christian was like holding the kid's hand, they're walking along the grass. No word of a lie. Several people in this theater audibly went,
"Oh my God."
And I'm like, you just saw this twerp blow a gasket because his wife got pregnant?
Yeah, my reaction was like, oh no, she's trapped.
Thank you. But and of course, during the whole kidnapping sequence where she's trying to save Christian's sister from Mr. Hyde, when she goes to the bank to get his ransom, and of course his first thought is like she's raiding his bank account to leave him, not that there's nothing wrong, like all of a sudden she's checking out $5 million from the bank. But we go from A to B to C, and there's kind of no, I can't remember the original point I was making, but I'm going to run with it. There's kind of no flow through. There's no scene where he's like, now I understand that, you know, I have to grow up and be a responsible adult, and I'm going to be a father, and you're right, you know, we're going to I'll get to this in a sec, but we're going to close down the playroom, or maybe, you know, just like rearrange our lives. And you know, now be parents and now be sort of grown adults. And now, like, the time for childish things is over.
Well, there was sort of that scene, just not with her. It was with his mom when she was...
Marcia Gay Harden.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you're right. That's another thing. The person who he sorts it out with
is
his mom, not his wife. Yeah. I hope they rename that room before the kid gets too much older, because it's like he's gonna like your playroom and think they're like Transformers.
Oh,
in
God.
There. It's like, well, Mom, Dad, why is this door always locked? It's the playroom. Oh, cool. No, not for you. But but yeah, it is surprisingly kind of just nothing really happens.
Yeah.
And there's side plots where nothing happens, like her friend Anna's friend Kate is dating Christian's brother, because that happens.
Yeah.
And she's concerned he's cheating on her, oddly enough, with the architect from the clip. And nothing comes from that. The brother proposes marriage to the friend, and it's like, oh, everybody's happy. And
yeah, for me, the biggest... like hanging plot point, I don't know if
the biggest
I don't know if it, I didn't know about this because I haven't seen any of the previous films, but we find out that like Hyde was in the same orphanage as Christian. What did the
I have no idea.
So it wasn't in previous movies.
There was nothing about that in the previous movie.
Weird.
But I was he sends them like a ransom note or some kind of note at one point where it's like, you owe me a life. It's what happened to a horse head in the bed. It's like I was sitting there going, and I was like, I could swear I was saying it out loud, like, he's his brother. I thought blood brother because he's adopted, Christian Grey's adopted, but it turns out that they were both like in the same foster home together, which. Semantics, but yeah, that's another thing too. It's like they did the Agatha Christie thing, except without like Clouseau or Miss Marple. It was a file, which shows you like how, you know, much thought goes into this thing. There's like there's a detective character who kind of swims in and out, who's like very Keystone Cop, but at the end they get a file delivered, and it's like, oh look, he was in the same foster home as you, and he's like, son of a gun, now we know what it's all about.
Yeah.
Let's go swimming. Or let's go to the playroom. Let's take this up a notch. It's like she, I don't know who was writing this. Well, I think it was actually L. James's husband who wrote the screenplay. Oh. But still, it there's no kind of sense of mystery building or tension building, and it just seems to happen. I will come back to that point. This all just kind of seems to happen, and again, I know I'm not the target audience for this, but it's hard for me to see the appeal. And I think I've been kinder to this movie than I think other critics have, because I've said there are things that, you know, there are ideas and themes, and there are aspects of the Anna character I find compelling. But it goes nowhere. They do nothing with it. Everybody just kind of like gets the easy way out. There's no sense of any sacrifice ever. Bad guys lose, good guys win, and the only thing that seems to make these movies stick out is the quote-unquote kink, which we've both talked about, turns out to be not very kinky.
Yeah.
And then there's the crappy messages about, you know, people being messed up and...
Yeah.
it's so hard to accept there's anything to this except, as you mentioned, one person's kind of fantasy, which is kind of... seems to be like a kind of stream of consciousness, because this didn't, you know how this started out, right?
It was a Twilight fan fiction,
right?
which like, our Twilight is already so terrible to begin with.
Let me tell you something, true confession, I have read all those Twilight books.
Have you?
Yes. And they suffer from the same problem, that in the end, good guys win, bad guys lose, everyone lives happily ever after, which is so dull.
Yeah.
And I was watching, what was I watching? Bill Maher. And he was talking about how, he was basically comparing like all this wish fulfillment books, and he was basically throwing 50 Shades and Twilight and Harry Potter all into the same category. But it's like Harry Potter, when you get to the end of the book, the seventh book, like he's been through some stuff.
Yeah.
His like friends have died, and his godson is parentless, like mirroring his own orphanage, and his best friend's older brother is like flat out murdered, and it's, he's seen things and been through things. It's like, you should get to that final chapter of the book where it's like 19 years in the future. Harry Potter should be living like Mark Wahlberg and Shooter, like in a shack on a mountainside somewhere, shooting cans of Dintymore beef stew with high powered rifles. And he'd be like, no, none of this, like no more human contact for me. there's a reality to that, because you do have to sacrifice, and he did make, Harry Potter does make, he walks into that forest like knowing he's going to be killed by Voldemort, spoiler alert for Harry Potter.
Yeah.
But there's nothing like that here. There's no weight to that here, and it's just all wish fulfillment, and it's all like cool sequences and awesome vacations. Mm-hmm. And boring sex that's supposed to look great, and nice clothes and fancy apartments and working out, I guess, because anyway, Jamie Dornan's a good looking man, I'll say that. I'm not,
but like a bad actor.
Yeah.
Like the acting was also really bad. There were so many like stilted, awkward scenes because of the acting, I found.
Yeah I'm not sure you want me to disagree.
if you don't agree, that's fine.
But yeah, I mean, but there's so many great people, and like Jennifer Eale has this thankless role as like the housekeeper, and Max Martini, what are you doing here? He plays like one of the bodyguards, and it's.
I was hoping that she would run away with him in the end.
But he's like, the bodyguards are terrible too.
When she's like, can you meet me in the library, and he doesn't suspect anything, and is like, oh crap, she escaped.
It's, yeah, I mean, the whole sequence, like where they're like they're being followed, and the security guards are following them, and they're like, guess we lost them. Yeah. And it turns out that it's like an accomplice of the old boss, and who is also not a spy, but apparently can drive and evade like a spy, like she's done like counter surveillance tactics at the CIA Academy or something. It's just, oh, it's all so silly. But we made through it.
Yeah, we did.
We survived 50 Shades Freed. Yeah. And you know what made me laugh is I was reading an article on one of the websites, but it was like an interview with Jamie Dornan, and he's like, no, there will not be any further 50 Shades of Grey movies. Like, this was the last one for me, and it's like, the last one for you. No kidding. The last one, he says. Anyway, that's 50 Shades Freed. See it in theaters if you dare. And that brings us to an end for this week's end credits, oddly enough. And if you want to listen to this episode again or catch us online, we're at endcreditsradioshow.com. We're also on the Facebook at End Credits Radio Show and on Twitter at End Credits Radio. Andrea, you work at CFRU, so what's going on at CFRU? Where can people hear you again?
Hear me on Thursday mornings at 9 a.m. I host Indie Alarm Clock, a one-hour-long radio show of independent music.
Nice, nice. Yeah. And then we come on at 10.
So yeah.
It's like 2 hours. People are going to get have gotten a double bill of Andrea this week. It's,
I'm sorry.
Apology accepted. I will be back here later today, actually, on Thursday at 5 p.m. here for News and Politics on Open Sources Guelph with my partner there, Scotty Hertz. And you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson. And check out guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca. Stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And we'll be back here next Thursday at 10 a.m. for more end credits. And we will see you then.